This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center reading The Atlantic Magazine. Beginning today with an essay titled, Boatfish Don't Count. The Wild, Obsessive, Dangerous Pursuit of Montauk's Biggest Striped Bass by Tyler Austin Harper. The wave comes, throat high and hungry. The last thing I see before it sweeps me off the rock and into the ocean is a man in a wetsuit leaning his shoulder into a wall of water. When we swam out here around 2 a.m. and hoisted ourselves onto the algae-slick face of a boulder, he had warned me, "If you go in here, it won't be fun." And he was right. I managed to keep hold of my fishing rod, and I'm reeling in lost line and treading water and trying to forget all the stories I've heard about sharks as a second large wave begins sucking me up its face. By the time the third crashes over me, I've abandoned any pretense of swimming back to our original perch. Sputtering and coughing, I make my way toward another rock closer to shore. A last wave pushes me onto it, and I get my feet under me. 30 yards in front of me, having held on to that sloping rock through the entire set, Brandon Saucily makes a long, arcing cast into the pounding surf. Saucily is 27 years old. Shaggy-haired, tattooed, and muscular, he is a devoted practitioner of an extreme sport known as wetsuiting, which is both easy to describe and impossible for the uninitiated to understand. When I was first getting into the sport a few years ago, the advice I received from another fisherman was simply, don't. Wetsuiting is a form of saltwater fishing that involves wearing a wetsuit and wading or swimming out to offshore rocks, almost exclusively at night, often during storms, to access deeper water or faster currents than can be reached in traditional waders. The quarry are striped bass, a fish that migrates every spring, mostly from the Chesapeake and Delaware Bays to as far north as Maine and back down again in the fall. Although stripers, one of the most popular game fish in America, can be caught during normal waking hours, the largest member of the species, some more than 4 feet long, usually come close to shore at night. Stripers prefer inclement weather and rough water, which make ambushing their prey easier, but also make conditions more dangerous for the men. Wetsuiters are nearly all men who chase them. Catching big stripers requires dedication and sleep deprivation. And if you're wetsuiting, it involves more than a little risk. The hazards of this hobby, coupled with the fact that most of us who do it don't even keep the fish we catch, are often baffling to outsiders, who quite reasonably wonder why we bother. Perhaps not surprisingly, wetsuiting has long attracted highly particular personalities, cranks, brooding combat veterans, adrenaline junkies, recovering alcoholics, and spiritual questers. Fishing for striped bass from the shore, known as surf casting, was once a pastime for the rich, who created clubs and built bass stands in places such as Newport and Cuttyhunk Island in the 1800s. But what Saucily does, wetsuiting, was born in the mid-20th century in Montauk, New York, back when it was a hardscrabble fishing town. Who exactly invented the sport is a matter of substantial debate, but it's generally agreed on that by the early 1960s, a handful of men were donning wetsuits and swimming sometimes 100 yards or more through the churning surf to reach the sandbars and outer rocks on Montauk's shores. Montauk's geography is uniquely perfect for the sport. Situated at the eastern tip of Long Island's South Fork, which some call simply the End, the town has a mix of sand beaches, boulder fields, and ripping currents that provides an ideal habitat for stripers and a singular challenge for those who hunt them. By most standards, I'm a serious wetsuiter. I go out some 80 nights a year. but I was not fully prepared for the nights I spent on Long Island this summer, fishing with one of the most celebrated anglers on Montauk's coastline. Wetsuiters often talk about their career in fishing, and Saucily has already had a decorated run. He has 7 Montauk Surf Masters tournament victories to his name and a 50 under his belt. Catching a 50-pound striped bass is an achievement that most spend their life chasing and very few attain. During the day, Saucily works as a pipeline rehabilitation specialist, traveling the country to repair lines that carry water, chemicals, and natural gas. But like most diehard wetsuiters, he treats fishing as his second job, which means foregoing anything approaching a healthy sleep schedule. Saucily regularly fishes from sunset to sunrise before driving 90 minutes from Montauk back home to change, then he goes straight to work. This isn't uncommon. Most dedicated wetsuiters are out in the surf multiple nights a week from May to November. Some junkies log 100 or more nights a year. In this prolonged state of sleep deprivation, wetsuiters must keep constant track of moon phases, bait migration, wind direction, tide swings, current speed, water temperature, swell and surf conditions, knowing that a single mistake can spell injury or worse. Wetsuiters pursue a fish, yes, but also an old and very human question. What can a body do? I sought out Saucily because he's a good fisherman, really good, but also because he is, as he himself puts it, one of a dying breed. By Saucily's estimate and that of other Montauk fishermen I talked with, only about 5 or 6 hardcore wetsuiters fish the end regularly today, down from dozens in the 90s and 2000s. Many local fishermen still wear a wetsuit, but vanishingly few swim out to Montauk's far-flung reefs at night. In part, that's because Montauk has long since become a vacation spot for influencers and Wall Street guys, pushing out the working class and making it harder for fishermen to find affordable places to stay. It's also because striper numbers have dropped after years of inadequate conservation. But just as much as any of these reasons, it's a story about sharks. Because if there's one thing keeping Montauk wetsuiters shorebound, it's the shark population. Saucily often takes to Instagram to share videos and images of large bass bitten in half by the tax man while he is reeling them in, as well as other encounters he has with large sharks while precariously perched on offshore rocks, most of which are submerged, leaving him belly deep with predators bigger than he is. In one video, he releases what looks like a sizable bull shark at night. It had hooked itself after eating a bluefish on his line. If this sounds insane, that's because it is. Wetsuiters are all mad, and they always have been. Spending sleepless night after sleepless night up to your chest in the riotous Atlantic, hunting fish the size of a preschooler, isn't a hobby that people who are psychologically grounded pursue. I do not exempt myself from this charge. Many disciples speak about their relationship with the sport as a kind of addiction. More than a few have lost marriages and jobs in their desperate quest for this fish. Some have lost their life. I went down to Long Island in June and again in July, a time of year when shark run-ins are common, to swim to the outer rocks with Saucily in an attempt to understand why he risks life and limb chasing massive fish only to release them, with nothing but the occasional Instagram post and a few hundred likes to show for it. Wetsuiters have a mantra, boat fish don't count. It's often said tongue-in-cheek, but most of us sort of mean it. I've thought about the meaning of this phrase a lot, on the long drives to my fishing spots, while wading out neck-deep to sandbars in white shark territory, in a parking lot gearing up to fish the bleeding edge of a hurricane. Boat fish don't count because, generally, Boat fishing can't kill you. I arrive in Montauk during the first week of June, my wife and 7-month-old in tow. We haven't been away together since our son was born, so we decided to make the trip a family affair, staying in one of the rental homes that are helping to drive up the town's housing prices. We get in on a Monday afternoon and spend the evening like tourists, drinking South Fork rosé at a picnic table and watching the sun sink into Lake Montauk. 24 hours later, Brandon Saucily is giving me a firm handshake in a dirt and gravel parking lot. Although we talked on the phone several times in the months leading up to my trip, Saucily takes me a little by surprise. You might expect a man who swims through a shark-infested ocean at night to be brash and full of swagger. Saucily is not quiet, but he is understated and modest. He asks me questions about my gear, whether I like a certain brand of hook, if I have thoughts on a certain kind of plug, an artificial lure. It's a bit like if Phil Mickelson asked an amateur golfer his opinion on a particular 9-iron. After a few minutes of chit-chat, we're piling into Saucily's truck and driving to a second location, where we'll slip into our wetsuits and prepare for the night. He tells me he doesn't like to get ready in the same place that he's fishing, in case he's recognized by another wetsuiter who might try to horn in on his bite. This kind of secrecy is typical. I have my own similar routines and rituals that shade from privacy into paranoia. We take our time getting our gear together. Pool cue thick rods and waterproof reels made of aircraft-grade aluminum. Plug bags made of sailcloth attached to thick belts made of scuba material. Rust-proof rescue knives, primary and backup dive flashlights attached to lanyards made of surgical tubing, nitrile-coated gloves, specialized shoes called corkers fitted with carbide cleats designed to grip rock, an assortment of other tools, including pliers, stainless steel D-rings, and handheld scales to weigh fish. And finally, with those sharks in mind, tourniquets. By 8 o'clock, we've driven to a third location, and I'm wading deep into the Montauk surf with Saucily. Our first perches are maybe 60 yards offshore, a pair of flat rocks that we can reach without swimming. He directs me to the bigger of the two, and we fish until the blue wash of sky turns purple and the ebbing tide sucks out a little farther. He keeps a polite eye on me. "All right," Saucily announces. Night has fully set in, and soon I'm watching Saucily's dark form side-stroking through the choppy Atlantic, using his 11-foot surf rod to feel for a specific rock that allegedly lies somewhere below the surface. He does this without turning on his flashlight, so as not to spook the fish. As he later explains, he locates these underwater rocks, which he scouts during the day, by triangulating from various onshore landmarks. The water is pushing fast, and he starts his swim up current, letting it swing him toward the rock. A few minutes later, I can just make out Saucily's silhouette standing some 40 yards in front of me. He signals for me to join him. I slip into the black water. As Saucily promised, the rock is plenty big but awkwardly shaped. The water is well above my waist, even when I'm standing on the highest part. I've fished plenty of difficult places. My home waters offer miles of ledge-studded coastline, craggy death traps battered by New England tides. But Montauk is an entirely different animal. I'm not used to fishing from rocks that are this deeply submerged, and the surf is frothing and the current tugs at me. Within the first 10 minutes, a big roller comes in and pushes me off into deep water. Saucily extends a hand and pulls me back on, only for the next wave to push me off again. This time I swim around to the front of the boulder and let the next wave deposit me belly first onto the rock. We don't catch any stripers that night, and my entire body aches. Saucily stays on that slimy boulder like he's glued to it, while I seem to spend as much time swimming back to our rock as I do fishing from it. Nevertheless, the entire affair is deliriously fun. Wetsuiting can feel illicit, almost juvenile, courting danger while the rest of the world sleeps, the sense that something exciting, catching not just a fish but the fish, could happen at any moment. When the sky brightens over the distant Montauk Point Lighthouse, Saucily's watch reads 4:45, and we call it quits. We mostly float back, paddling with the hands not holding our rods, relying on the buoyancy of our wetsuits and letting the waves push us toward shallow water. Back on shore, we stand on the rocky beach, panting lightly, leaning on our surf rods like canes under Montauk's crumbling bluffs. A sliver of moon is dissolving into the morning. Saucily says he hopes the fishing will be better tomorrow. The teenager in the surf shop is tanned and stoned. When I tell him I'm working on a story about fishermen, striped bass, and sharks, his bloodshot eyes flash, his mouth splitting into a grin. "Oh, the sharks are here, man." He leans back on his stool until it's balanced on two legs. "I've seen them two different times. One night I was out at dusk, whole crowd of surfers, and we see this big fin coming down the lineup, just effing cruising." He presses his hands together and makes them swim like a fish. "Just effing cruising," he repeats. And we're all like, "Shit, you know?" I agree. He forgets to tell me about the second time he saw a shark. It's been a month since my June trip, and I'm back in town. When I pull into the parking lot around midnight, Saucily is tying a monofilament leader to his braided fishing line, fingers lit up by the beam of a headlamp. We had fished hard the day before, meeting at midnight and staying out through sunrise with only two bass and some hefty bluefish, all released for our efforts. When I got back to the parking lot of my beachside motel that morning, vacationers were already ambling toward the ocean, weighed down by coolers and sandy beach chairs. I slept until 10 a.m. Saucily went straight to his job. It's the week of July 4, when sandbar sharks and other species typically begin showing up in Montauk in big numbers. Saucily hasn't had a fish bitten in half yet this season, but during the height of summer it can be a weekly, sometimes daily, occurrence. He expects his first visit from the tax man any day now, a prospect that doesn't seem to cause him much anxiety, though it keeps my heart rate up. Craig O'Connell, the director of the OC's Conservation Foundation, who is also known as the Shark Doctor and has appeared on Shark Week, told me that on top of a growing sandbar shark population, the Montauk Surf is also home to white sharks, duskies, spinners, bulls, and sand tigers. These are reportedly behind Long Island's recent uptick in attacks. When I asked Oliver Shipley, a marine biologist who studies Long Island's sharks, if he thought it was safe to go wetsuiting at night during Montauk's summer months, he let out a peal of laughter. He said he's seen some of Saucily's Instagram videos. Shipley emphasized that it's important not to demonize sharks and that attacks on humans remain extraordinarily rare. Though some fishermen feel like the shark population, especially sandbars, is exploding, he said, it's actually rebounding after decades of decline as a result of effective conservation efforts. But he also said that he personally would not go swimming after dark, smelling like fish and eels, common striper bait, looking like a harbor seal in black neoprene. Shipley's gallows laughter is on my mind tonight as I'm pushing out toward an eddy that marks the location of a submerged rock a short distance from the one Saucily is already on. I'm uncomfortably aware of how soft a human belly is as I swim. I scramble onto my rock and try, and fail, not to look like a wounded seal. I've spent plenty of time in New England waters at night during the peak of our white shark season, but I've never actually seen or encountered a white, which are relatively uncommon and often interested in chasing larger prey than striped bass, whereas the ubiquity of Montauk's sandbar sharks as well as the fact that we're both chasing the same fish, means there are a decent chance I'll come across one of them. While I stand on my rock with the tide incoming, bioluminescent algae sparking around my waist, I think of the stories I've heard from other Montauk wetsuiters, releasing a large bass only to hear the surface erupt 10 feet away as a shark strikes it, exploratory bumps on the leg from curious sandbars, 8-foot-long shadows cruising cresting waves, a large fin surfacing in front of your rock, then slipping beneath the surface. Two of Saucily's friends join us, swimming out through the incoming tide. They are among the very small number of people he fishes and shares information with. During the glory days of Montauk wetsuiting, when dozens of fishermen regularly pushed out to the farthest rocks, wetsuiters often worked in crews, cooperating to scout new territory and claim choice rocks. As Saucily and his friends banter, getting washed off their rocks and cracking jokes at one another's expense, laughing at the prospect of being eaten, I catch a glimpse of what it might have been like at its peak. As John Pepchiak, a still active fisherman who wetsuited in Montauk in the 90s and early 2000s, told me, the crews were in no small part about commiserating amid discomfort. A season in the surf is an accumulation of petty miseries broken by fleeting triumphs. Permanent sand in your boots, the wetsuit that never fully dries from one night to the next, the October waves that hit you in the face, and the feeling that you'll never be warm again. The trudging, flashlight-free walks through the woods or along the beach at night, trying to keep your secret spot a secret. The hunger for sleep, and the all-too-real risks. Pepchiak warned me that I should not glamorize wetsuiting, and during our hour-long conversation, he reminded me again and again how dangerous the sport is. He mentioned an acquaintance who had washed up lifeless in the surf on Cuttyhunk Island and told me stories of his own close calls. But I also noticed the twinkle in his eye as he told them. Anyone who is being honest will tell you that wetsuiting is a sport of considerable torment. But there is also nothing like it. When you feel the bracing hit of a 30 or 40-pound striped bass after 6 hours of futile casting, and the line goes singing off your reel all at once, and your rod is bucking and the surf is building, and you're trying to hold your rock and hold your rod and weather the sea that wants to claim you until suddenly, as if by magic, you see a tail the size of a broom head spraying water at your feet. In that moment, the months of pain are all worth it. The truth is, it's worth it even when the fish aren't there. And they aren't in Montauk, at least this time. Neither are the sharks. None that we see, anyway. We swim off our rocks at 3 a.m. Saucily needs a Red Bull, one of his friends needs a cigarette, and another needs to get his car into the driveway before his wife realizes he sneaked out again. If one of my kids waked her up, I'm effed, he says, laughing. Saucily asks if I'm up for regrouping and swimming back out to fish through sunrise. The only sleep he's gotten in 2 days is the 2 hours he grabbed in his truck before we met up tonight. I haven't slept much more than he has, and I have a long drive ahead of me. I remind myself that my wife and son are expecting me to return in one piece, and that the most dangerous part of wetsuiting is what happens not in the water, but on the sleep-deprived trip home. I tell him I should get back to my motel and rack out for a few hours. He understands. His friends disperse. Saucily gives me a fist bump, and I watch him disappear again beneath a maze of stars. I listen to the death rattle of the Atlantic as it sucks sea-polished stones and one fisherman back into its embrace. Through the summer, I continue to hear from Saucily that the fishing in Montauk is tough. Anecdotally, it seems tough everywhere. Maine, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut. The story is the same. The most talented wetsuiters I know report their worst season ever. So when I return for a third and final trip to the end in late July, my expectations are low. You take what Montauk gives, Cicely's friend tells me as we're bullshitting on the shore, and lately she isn't giving much. But tonight, Montauk is generous. Around 1 a.m., Cicely's rod doubles over. Minutes later, he's treading in deep water, cradling in his arms a bass that weighed in at 29 pounds, reviving her until she's ready to swim off. "That water's murky," Cicely observes with a grin. I know he's thinking about those sandbars that love to steal an easy meal. We spend the rest of the night on a minivan-sized boulder that Cicely's crew calls Shark Mountain, the site of his aforementioned bull shark video. No other fish make an appearance, and I wonder if this is normal now. For at least a decade, anglers, conservationists, and fisheries biologists have been warning that the striped bass population is in crisis, thanks to a combination of overfishing and poor spawning years due to unusually warm and dry springs and winters. Between commercial fishing, guided charters, and recreational angling, stripers represent a multi-billion dollar industry composed of stakeholders who always seem to think that someone else is the problem. The recreational fishermen accuse the comms of harvesting too many fish. The commercial fishermen respond by pointing out that the wrecks kill more than their share annually and that a percentage of released fish still die. And on and on. In the attempt to keep everyone happy, the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission has long avoided making the hard decisions, namely declaring a moratorium on harvesting striped bass, necessary to allow striper numbers to rebound. The species population collapsed once before in the 1980s, and many of us think we're on the verge of another collapse if we're not there already. If it does happen again, it may well prove the final blow to Montauk's wetsuiting scene. Like any town that was once a fishing town and is now that and something else, Montauk is a sprawl of contradictions. In the past 15 or so years, the End has been transformed into a summer gathering spot for the rich, a fate that was perhaps inevitable given the proximity to the wealthier Hamptons. Nearly every local I spoke with referred, with some degree of ambivalence, to the 2008 appearance of Surf Lodge, a clubby, celebrity-filled hotel where rooms can start at $600 a night during the peak summer months, as the town's point of no return. Our BCAD, one said. The crusty dive bars that once gave Montauk its character, a local fishing legend, Bill Wetzel, told me that surf rats used to pull up a bar stool still dripping in their wetsuits, are now something like vestigial organs, touchstones from an earlier moment in its evolutionary history that are gradually being pushed to the margins by new Montauk. There are beachside cocktail joints with $22 Negronis. There is SoulCycle and Green Juice. There are Land Rovers with custom golf clubs in the passenger seat. There are big houses with perfect lawns that sit empty 50 weeks out of 52. There are finance boys lined up outside the Shagwang Tavern, where they will dance badly to a bad DJ on the same floor where commercial fishermen slop beer in the hard winter. But for now, at least, they also remain the men who ply the dark surf, who fish hard and sleep little, and pull a great American fish from the ocean, and know, as all fishermen know, that there is a kind of love that is also violence. And if it is around dusk, and you take the parkway east toward the lighthouse, and you drive until you can't drive anymore, you might still see them. They will be changing hooks and checking lights and strapping dive knives to their ankles and heavy belts to their waists. They drink Red Bull and gas station coffee, and read texts from their wives that say, "Be safe." And when the sun sets over the Atlantic, a few of these last Ahabs will push out past the breakers and swim for the horizon. Next, from the Atlantic's books section, Rachel Kushner's surprising swerve. She and her narrators have always relied on swagger, but not this time. By Lily Meyer. Sometimes I am boggled by the gallery of souls I've known, by the lore, the wild history unsung. Rachel Kushner writes in The Hard Crowd, her 2021 essay collection. People crowd in and talk to me in dreams, people who died or disappeared or whose connection to my own life makes no logical sense, but exists as strong as ever in a past that seeps and stains instead of fades. As a girl in San Francisco's Sunset District, Kushner ran with a group whom she has described as ratty delinquents, kids who fought, set fires, and who got high too young and too often, who in some cases wound up incarcerated or addicted or dead. At 16, she headed to UC Berkeley for college, but returned to the city after graduating, working at bars and immersing herself in the motorcycle scene. Almost immersing herself, anyway. Even when she was a 14-year-old sampling strangers' drugs at rock concerts, some piece of Kushner was an observer as well as a participant, a student of unsung histories. In her fiction, Kushner gravitates toward main characters who occupy that same split psychological place. All of her novels, her latest, Creation Lake, is her fourth, feature a young woman, usually a narrator, who shares her way of viewing the world. Kushner often loans her protagonists her own biker swagger, the hard layer of confidence that helps a woman survive in a very male environment. Preferring to write in the first person, she also gives her central characters her distinctive style. Kushner is alternately warm and caustic, funny and slippery, able to swing from high literary registers to street slang and back in an instant. Her recurring theme has been the limits that even groups of outsiders impose on women, and yet her female characters, no matter how constrained they find themselves, are roving, curious thinkers, using their keen powers of observation to escape subjugation and victimhood in their minds, if not in their circumstances. With every book, Kushner has grown more interested in the push-pull between material restriction and psychic freedom. She's especially intrigued by the effect that gender roles have on her characters' strategies for navigating that tension. In each of her novels, a woman tries to both resist and exploit conventional ideas about female behavior. One of the main characters in Telex from Cuba, her 2008 debut, is a burlesque dancer named Rachel Kay. Her name is taken from a real historical figure, though of course Kushner is winking in the mirror, whose very literal performance of femininity attracts some of the most powerful men in pre-revolutionary Cuba. Her evident goal is to use these men to her own ends, but she winds up getting conscripted into their service instead. Such failures of self-liberation continue through Kushner's next novel, 2013's The Flamethrowers, which was a breakout for her. Its protagonist, Reno, is a biker and emerging artist who covets the independence and aura of influence that seem to come so easily to the men in both the art world and the 1970s Italian radical underground, of which she briefly becomes a part. Unlike Rachel Kay, Reno's not a seductress. She's not interested in seducing the reader either. What Reno offers in place of charm is commentary so wryly smart and dispassionate that, especially in contrast with the male blowhards she repeatedly encounters, she seems powerful. But over the course of the novel, Kushner builds a skidding sense of perilousness, a feeling that no one, Reno included, is in charge or exempt from the mounting chaos. In the end, as Reno and the reader may have sensed all along, her detachment is just another performance, a cool girl put on, not so different from Rachel Kay's burlesque. The irony that the aloof observer stance turns into yet another trap is not lost on either Kushner or her narrators. Romy, the protagonist of The Mars Room, 2018, takes especially bleak stock of her plight, and for good reason. She's serving two life sentences after killing a stalker who latched onto her at the Market Street strip club where she worked and began menacing her and her child in their private life. For Romy, her flat narration, counterposed with excerpts from the Unabomber's diary and chapters voiced by a sex-obsessed crooked cop, is a way of walling herself off, creating the mental freedom to imagine escape. Whether flight is a real act of hope, though, remains deliberately ambiguous. It may be an attempt at suicide. Again and again, Kushner scrambles conventional ideas about gender, skewering male bravado while also subverting familiar ideas of femininity. Who and what counts as weak, she wants to know, and why? Stubborn stereotype portrays women as prey to emotion, unable to rein themselves in. Yet in book after book, her protagonist's relentless restraint has stood in stark contrast to the egotistical, violent impulsiveness of the men around them. In Creation Lake, Kushner complicates this dynamic. Her protagonist, Sadie Smith, is another dispassionate observer, but one who appears to have far more independence and agency than her predecessors. She's a lone wolf, a private intelligence agent who has shucked off her home, her past, and even her name. Sadie Smith is an alias. At the novel's start, she's en route to the Guyenne, a rural region in southwestern France, where she's been hired to spy on Pascal Balmy, the leader of Les Moulins, a group of environmental radicals intent on sabotaging big agriculture. She has no idea who's paying her or what their larger agenda might be, and yet she's convinced that she's playing her assigned part to perfection. Indeed, she has such faith in her toughness, acuity, and ability to dupe men that she considers herself all but invincible. Her vigilant predecessors, Romy and Reno, were much warier and wiser than Sadie, who loves bragging that any innocence she displays is just a pose. Creation Lake is not a conventional spy novel, but unlike Kushner's shaggy earlier books, it often feels as tight as a thriller. Sadie's secret bosses have sent her to the Guyenne not just to embed herself in Pascal's group, but to undermine it. Gradually, readers understand that her assignment has a deadlier side, a realization that Sadie either suppresses or notices less quickly than she should, perhaps the most glaring giveaway that she's not quite the clever spy she thinks. She's sloppy, distractible, as drunk on her perception of her own power as any engine-revving king of the road, to use her derisive phrase for the swell-headed bikers among whom she first went undercover. Sadie is also more impressionable and less happy than she's ready to admit, which generates psychological ferment beneath the surface espionage plot. Creation Lake gets some of its suspense from its action, but Kushner mainly builds tension inside her narrator's head. Sadie spends much of the novel reading Pascal's correspondence with Bruno Lacombe, an aging philosopher whose opposition to modern civilization inspired Les Moulins at its founding. Living in a cave now, he reveres the collaborative and artistic Neanderthals, who huddled modestly and dreamed expansively. Initially, she dismisses Bruno's ideas as crackpot, but they come to preoccupy her. For years, she's told herself that she was content to carry out small parts of big, murky plans, duly suppressing her curiosity. Bruno's emails urge her to take a broader, more inquisitive view of humanity, of history, of alternative ways she could live. But once Sadie starts asking questions, things inside her start falling apart. Not least, she starts questioning masculinity, or rather her ideas about it, which have dictated her espionage strategies and what she considers her success in the field. In the presence of others, Sadie, the operative, plays up her feminine sexual allure and compliance, but Sadie, the narrator, treats readers to a distinctly macho version of swagger. More than once, she notes that her breast augmentation is a calculated professional asset. She seems convinced that the same is true of her rootlessness and emotional disengagement. A hard drinker and frat boy-style slob, she often seems to be trying to outman the men around her in her own mind, even as she must submit to them in reality. Perhaps Sadie's most traditionally masculine quality is her terror of weakness. But over the course of Creation Lake, as Sadie's mission within Les Moulins gets riskier, she sees that her constant projection of control is alienating her from her desires, hollowing out her vaunted autonomy, making her easy to manipulate. She's shattered, doubly so because falling apart emotionally shocks her. It's a fate Kushner withheld from her previous, more guarded protagonists. By letting tough guy Sadie break down, she writes a radical conversion that is also a bold authorial leap. Kushner lets herself ask, for the first time in her career, what happens to a woman unmoored by masculine and feminine categorizing? Putting Sadie under such intense pressure changes Creation Lake's nature as a story. Once Sadie starts cracking, the novel doesn't become digressive and loose like its predecessors, but it certainly stops feeling like a thriller. After many chapters that seemed to build to a dramatic act of sabotage, the story shifts register, heading into a very different, more emotional denouement. Relinquishing some swagger, Kushner opens up in her writing to new levels of feeling and possibilities for change. In the process, she shakes up gender stereotypes in new ways. Creation Lake asks what sources of strength might be found in the kind of vulnerability, physical and emotional, that is associated with femininity. Sadie has prided herself on her supremely instrumental view of sex. She'd never get hysterical, never get too attached, or lose her reason over a man. Although the strategic romance she's begun with Lucian, a friend of Pascal's, physically disgusts her, she boasts about not letting that get in her way. Kushner leans into the irony here. The reader sees well before Sadie does that her employers are exploiting precisely this blind willingness to obey them at real emotional cost to herself. For all that she wants to treat her body as a professional resource, she can't do it. Kushner's exploration of sex as a catalyst for Sadie's emotions breaking free is fascinating. Repelled by Lucian, she risks her job by beginning an affair with a partnered member of Les Moulins that starts out enjoyable but leaves her feeling abject. In its aftermath, Sadie begins nursing bigger doubts about her life. This drama could seem retrograde, but coming from Kushner, a restored connection between female body and mind feels less traditional than transformative. Sex isn't Sadie's only route to a softer self. She also follows a more intellectual path to which she is led by Bruno, the cave-dwelling philosopher. Although Bruno has retreated from contemporary society, his reflections are what gets Sadie to reconsider her pride in her nomadic self-sufficiency. She has long bridled at the notion that women should do and enjoy domestic work and is emphatic that she will never have a baby. But she's swayed by Bruno's devotion to the painted caves and their former inhabitants, and by her own images of Bruno as a father, after she learns that he has grown children. Indeed, she develops a sort of daughterly love for Bruno. By the end of the novel, his meditations bring out the feelings that she has most wanted to suppress: homesickness, nostalgia, loneliness. After reading an email in which Bruno describes his sense of being existentially lost, she says aloud, "I feel that way, too." The sound of her voice let something into the room, Sadie goes on, some kind of feeling. The feeling was mine even as I observed it, watched myself as if from above. What Sadie sees is herself crying alone in bed, an image more suited to a teen movie than a Kushner novel. Yet this moment is no performance. In the grip of uncontrollable emotion, Sadie recognizes both her vulnerability and her desire to drastically change her life. For Kushner, too, lowering the barricades against the clichés of femininity has an effect at once jarring and liberating. Her earlier novels veer away from culminating clarity, their explosive yet enigmatic endings reminding readers that her characters are too trapped and disempowered to change in the ways they want to. In Creation Lake, Sadie's transfigured consciousness is a kind of resolution that might be mistaken for a sentimental promise of sunniness ahead, except that Kushner gives her narrator a new, daunting challenge. At the novel's close, Sadie has already started experimenting with a life in which she engages fully rather than contorting herself to perform roles that others expect. She's now armed with an agenda of her own, one that promises to turn her into a woman who couldn't care less about anyone thinks woman means. Creation Lake's radicals aren't likely to upend society, but Sadie's swerve suggests that Kushner is ready for big change. And from the Atlantic's culture section, men on trips eating food. Why TV is full of late-career Hollywood guys at restaurants, by James Parker. As a reverse foodie, a rudy, a gastronomically ungluty, a don't-bother-cooking-for-that-duty, I'm not exactly a target viewer for the eating and traveling shows. I'm happy sitting behind my stacked-up cans of Dintymore beef stew, reading Frederick Seidel. But now and again I'm touched. An image or a moment from one of these shows will move me. Like the sequence in Season 6, Episode 8 of Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown, in which Bourdain, God rest his troubled soul, sits down with Sean Brock at a Waffle House in Charleston, South Carolina. To set the scene, Bourdain has never been to a Waffle House before. Brock, by contrast, a southern chef in a baseball cap, is a lifelong connoisseur, not just of the food, that golden-griddled, all-forgiving food, that eternal breakfast mystically charged with the democratic yellow glow of Waffle House neon, but of the open all hours, come all ye faithful, come all ye effed up, Waffle House vibe. This was action to me, he tells Bourdain. I would see these people cooking at a pace and cooking for people who are completely out of control but still providing hospitality. For his guest, he has devised a tasting menu experience, one delirious grease load after another, and as the food hits them, the two men lose their minds. They slump and surrender and dissolve into a single, namelessly buzzing poetic orality. Patty melt! Ah, come on, that's not insanely delicious. That's not insanely delicious. Ooh, goddamn. Why is this so beautiful? Because the ambiance and the cultural context, the pure, generous, flavorous, spiritually flowing Waffle House-ness of the moment, are enfolded in the reaction. The faces that Brock and Bourdain make and the noises coming out of these faces as they express and share the intensely and otherwise invisibly subjective experience of tasting something. It's the primal spark, I think, of the eating and traveling show. White guy goes a-wandering, white guy goes a-gourmandizing. That's the rubric. Specifically, right now, late-career Hollywood white guy. Phil Rosenthal, the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond, has Somebody Feed Phil on Netflix. Eugene Levy has The Reluctant Traveler on Apple TV+. Stanley Tucci has Staniel Tucci, Searching for Italy, on Discovery Plus. Nice work if you can get it. And the genre has been formalized. Drone shots of fjords, mesas, and Mumbai street markets. Glistening porno food close-ups. Tinkly twinkly music. Voiceovers saying things like, "The Venetians are a thrifty people." These are the common elements, episode after episode, proposing itself as a kind of anemic picaresque, in which the host/hero visits a strange place where no misadventures occur, no sex is had, and everyone is very obliging and laughs a little too readily, ha ha ha, and gives him nice pieces of pork and yummy desserts. Each of these guys has his shtick. Rosenthal is childlike and immoderately gleeful, always doing little dances in the street and giggling before he takes a bite of something. And he, too, has his Waffle House moment. It happens to him, it claims him, at Bait Maryam, a Levantine restaurant in Dubai. Chef Salam Dakak, her face illumined by some kind of beatific culinary compassion, prepares for Phil, with her hands, a dish of kibbeh naya, raw meat ground with bulgur and spiced with cumin, cloves, marjoram, and cinnamon. Phil builds himself a mouthful with bread and a slice of onion, giggles, shoves it in, and he is gone, overcome by sensory resonance. The tigger energy is abruptly stilled, replaced by a silently welling solemnity. It's a stirring sight. Phil as low-rent Proust, unable to find the words. "I have to tell you something," he says at last. "It's so wild to feel an emotion in the food." Levy is deadpan and hedonic, a prisoner of his own eyebrows. Some of his observations seem to be a challenge to the very concept of interestingness. Breakfasting on a balcony is Saint-Tropez. "The food is exceptionally good and, you know, the view is stunning. I mean, you can see why this is such a popular place in Europe. It's absolutely gorgeous, really." Tucci in Italy is mysterious, saturnine, bald as a saint, strolling about in a subdued ecstasy of dapperness, sockless and stubbled, scarf knotted just so. His fine, downward-tending actor's cadence ripples through the commentary. Reaction-wise, he's a minimalist, relying on the calligraphy of his thick-framed glasses and the lean planes of his face to communicate a deep inwardness of foodie joy. Except in Sicily, for some reason, where he becomes particularly expressive. "I want to live with you," he tells one chef after a bite of raw fish, and "I want to take a bath in it," after a swallow of local wine. There's a countercultural aspect, given the state of things right now, given the roar in the ether, to these shows. The niceness in them is pervasive, like a contagion. People are taking their time, perfecting their crafts, enjoying their lives. Tremendous local pride, but no tribalism. A spirit of welcome everywhere. Very alienating after a while. You'll crave some anarchy, some venom, some madness. As Jim Henson put it when he was pitching The Muppet Show to TV stations, the time is right for a variety show hosted by dogs, frogs, and monsters. Which is why, after Phil and Eugene and Stanley, you must watch Conan. Conan O'Brien has been getting more and more interesting. Now 61, he's an elder statesman of comedy, chortling away with the celebrity guests on his podcast, Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, and reminiscing about the high days of Saturday Night Live. But as he ages, he's also becoming wilder and clownier and more unstably and violently ginger, as if there's an Eric Andre crashing around inside of him, or one of the Jackass crew. Did you see him on Hot Ones? This is the YouTube talk show, sort of an anti-food show, where guests, while attempting to answer the eloquent and searching questions of the host, Sean Evans, must work their way through progressively more annihilating levels of hot sauce on a chicken wing. It's a great show. Guests are regularly reduced to, in Martin Amis's phrase, tears of barbaric nausea. And O'Brien really goes for it. Sauce by sauce and wing by wing, he devastates himself. He gnaws, he drools, he emits steam. He changes color, and then changes again. His quiff twanging madly, he rubs hot sauce into his shirted nipples. Then, to the mild alarm of Evans, he guzzles the hottest, most dangerous sauce straight from the bottle, crying, "Why can't I feel?" So here he is, in the Dantean wood of midlife, advancing upon decrepitude, his palate destroyed by lethal peppers. The intro to his new show on Max, Conan O'Brien Must Go, is spoken by Werner Herzog, the voice from the iceberg crystallizing its syllables. Behold the defiler. Cue a montage of O'Brien variously writhing, collapsing onto bystanders, and floating down a Thai canal with a rubber chicken in his hand. His character is vile, base, and depraved, this clown with dull, tiny eyes, the eyes of a crudely painted doll. O'Brien knows all the tricks of the eating and traveling show. In Norway, he invites the ubiquitous drone into his hotel room. It floats down across Bergen Harbor. "Oh, man," O'Brien says in his voiceover, "look at this incredible drone shot. You gotta use drone cameras on these travel shows." Flies in through the balcony window and hovers by his bed as he sips a glass of red wine. In an Irish butcher's shop, he explains that he's got to taste the local food and react lavishly to it. The butcher gives him a couple of slices of black pudding, nothing fancy, a breakfast staple in Ireland, and O'Brien has a fake gastronomic fit. He falls to the floor, eyes closed, caressing his long thighs in erotic rapture. The butcher stands by, deadpanning, like Eugene Levy. Has O'Brien fluked his way to the dark, dark heart of it? Because maybe this is what they're all about, the eating and traveling shows. It's late in the day, and our taste buds have been blasted, and we've got to feel something. That includes this week's reading from The Atlantic. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you.